You know, the idea that we wake up every morning and every morning is a fresh start, is a fresh, a clean slate. I mean, that's a very important part, I think, of Catholic moral teaching, which gets lost because people tend to think of moral teaching as all the things that we do wrong. But actually, in a way, it's the fact that we're accepted by God, and that's where we begin. And therefore, this slate is it can always and will always be wiped clean.
That was Stephen Hough, who's known as one of the most distinctive artists of his generation, the classical pianist who performs with many of the world's major orchestras and in recital at concert halls around the world. I spoke with Stephen recently about his book, Rough Ideas, Reflection on Music and More, and we touched on a number of other things, too. This is Dominic Preziosi, and you're listening to the Commonweal Podcast. Fans of Stephen Hough probably already know that he's something of a polymath. He's not only a classical pianist, he's also a novelist, and he's written columns for The Times of London, The Guardian, and The Telegraph. I got to speak with Stephen recently about his latest book, Rough Ideas, Reflections on Music and More. It's a collection of writings that gathers dozens of charming and often perceptive reflections on the musician's craft, the symbiosis between the performer and the audience. He talks about Rilke, Simone Weil, Lou Reed, and the importance of practice, which, as he writes, allows the time to make mistakes and the leisure to correct them. One of the interesting things about the book, too, is that he tackles religion head on. Hough delves into scripture and the sacraments. He puzzles over certain dogmas. And in a longer and especially striking essay entitled, Is He Musical?, he speaks directly to the challenges that he has experienced as a gay Catholic. I talked to Stephen not only about that essay in particular, but a number of other things. I spoke to him in late April, just as the pandemic was reaching a crisis stage where he lives in London. So, Stephen, at this point in time, I'm eager first to hear how you're holding up now, quarantined like this and unable to perform in person for an audience. You got to some of this in an article in The Guardian in late March, writing that making solo music seems more sublime than ever. I just wonder if you could tell us how so, and do you still feel that way more than a month after you wrote that?
Well, it's a very strange time, isn't it? I don't think anyone feels that life is normal now. Some people are having a better time than others. I have spoken to friends who are enjoying it very much. Others are desperate to get out of their houses. I'm lucky, I suppose, in that when I'm not traveling, my life is to be here in London and to be practicing at home. But usually I've got tremendous stress of planning travel or planning repertoire. You know, next week I have to play this Rachmaninoff concerto in Atlanta, and then I have to fly to Taiwan. And all of that's been swept away. So in a funny sort of way, I am able to both relax and to work intensely. And I've been composing a lot. I had a number of commissions that I took on last year, and I've been able to work on those with tremendous intensity and concentration in a way that I don't think I've ever been able to do. So it's not as bad as it could be.
I want to talk a little bit about the book itself. And I'm curious because I found it to be a great read, and sort of its setup is very interesting. The way it's constructed is very interesting. So I'm curious how you came about to write this, where and when, and over how much time you penned the numerous reflections that make up the book, and how you went about organizing it.
Well, I guess the oldest pieces in there, although nothing in there has been unchanged from even when it was published before. I think every single paragraph has changes and many, many sentences in those paragraphs. Probably the oldest piece is about from 20 years ago. There's a book about Chopin and the development of piano technique that I wrote for an Australian publication. And that I completely revamped, but that's the oldest piece. And then there were pieces that were written, actually, even during the editing stages, a couple of extra chapters at that point. So it covers fully the last 20 years. It's a mix. The body of it was made up when I had a blog with the Daily Telegraph website about 10 years ago. And this blog, they asked if I would keep it, and I said I'd love to. I wasn't sure if I'd be able to write more than a dozen pieces, but I ended up writing over 600. And then at a certain point, they decided to close down the blogs. They just wanted a revamp of the whole website. And so they swept it away and, in fact, deleted everything. So it's not even there in an archive. And at first I thought, gosh, well, that was a lot of unpaid work that I'll never be able to get back again. But in fact, I'd kept notes for most of it and indeed early drafts of virtually all the pieces I wrote for that. So I got them all out and I printed them all out and I started sifting through. And I thought that I did have another book in there. You know, in fact, I took it down to around 100 of those from 600, but still there was enough meat there to make a new stew out of it. And so I started putting it together and I found there were certain themes that I returned to, you know, the theme of the practicality of playing the piano, certain tricks, experiences I have in the recording studio, on the road, tricks with overcoming nerves and so on. And so as I, it sort of all kind of fitted together bit by bit. And I took it to, I had a literary agent who'd worked with me on my novel, which came out a year before this. And I took this manuscript to him and he sent it to Faber and they really were very happy to publish it. And then Jonathan Galassi, who'd given me some very valuable knowledge of information and advice about my novel the year before, he was interested in publishing this too. So we went about getting it edited and sorted out and then it was published.
You know, I want to get to one of those pieces that makes up this stew, and it's a piece that I really enjoyed reading called Lonely on the Road, A Small Reflection. And in that, you write of the nomadic aspect of a performer being constantly on the road and the relationships you build with audiences as you move from concert to concert. And I just want to read a quote back to you and ask you maybe to sort of talk about what you were getting at. So the excerpt is this: "It forces on us an almost monastic discipline of indifference, married to none, so that we may be intimate with all." And I think there's a lot here to think about in terms of a performer's relationship with an audience and about the very nature of performance and the interaction and what it means. Can you speak to what this does to someone who thrives on performance, but maybe also what it does to those who thrive on being there to witness that performance, to share it with the artist?
Yes, well, it's interesting, isn't it? Concerts are, for some people, their main form of socializing. You know, it's the thing that they either take their spouse to as the treat of the week or of the month, or it's a place where they will meet their friends, maybe have dinner before or after. And so that's been taken away. And so the music in that context is an amplification of an evening's entertainment, if you like. And then I think for someone on the other side of the stage, like me, I see it. And obviously, I'm speaking to a magazine with a very strong Catholic identity. I also see it as a sort of apostolate in a way. You know, I think that not in a way of preaching direct dogma, but in the way that when I'm on stage, I do feel that I'm bringing something which is certainly more powerful than I am, which is the music written by people, usually not my own music, although I do sometimes play my own music, but people who are no longer alive. And I know from experience that music brings tremendous comfort. And actually, it goes underneath the surface into places that words can't reach. I go to places where priests and religion can't reach, the places where all of us join together. So my audience can be full of people who are Jewish, who are atheists, who are from all kinds of different backgrounds. And during that concert, we're sharing a very special experience. And I suppose it's an experience that Aquinas might link to beauty, you know, to beauty as the sort of the message from God. And so I don't always have this in mind because I'm usually nervous and thinking about things. And you know, and then I'm thinking about my own self so often during the concert. But at the best times, I think I have a real sense of that and a real sense of wanting the music to bring that kind of healing and comfort to people.
Thanks too for sort of mentioning the audience and what our listeners might like hearing about. And I invite you to sort of answer questions in that context as we go on, because some of my questions are framed in the hopes that you might address some of those issues that an audience like Common Wales might be interested in hearing. And you have another reflection in the book called Don't Listen to Recordings. And in that piece, you make the case that for aspiring musicians, reliance on and listening to the recordings of music is no substitute for practice, for really learning how to become a unique musician. And you talk about the importance of being allowed what you call the luxury of making mistakes and the leisure to correct them, concluding that individuality comes only when there's a properly formed individual in the first place. And I like this idea, and I'm wondering if you could talk to about it a little bit more, this idea of the luxury of making mistakes and how it contrasts to what seems like a prevailing craving for, well, if not perfection, I guess then technical mastery of something, and not just music, but even maybe living life in a way itself.
Yes, it didn't really strike me what a Catholic concept that was. You know, the idea that we wake up every morning and every morning is a fresh start, is a clean slate. I mean, that's a very important part, I think, of Catholic moral teaching, which gets lost because people tend to think of moral teaching as all the things that we do wrong. But actually, in a way, it's the fact that we're accepted by God, and that's where we begin, and therefore that this slate is, it can always and will always be wiped clean. I came across a book many years ago in the Franciscan bookshop. I don't know whether it's still there on 31st Street, attached to the Franciscan parish there, and it was propped up on the shelf there, and it's by James Allison, who's since become a friend of mine, a wonderful priest and theologian, and the title was The Joy of Being Wrong. And I really do think that's the most wonderful title of a book. And I bought the book without knowing anything about what was in it. And I'd never met or heard of James Allison at that point. But I think it's something that I've certainly found very helpful in my musical life. Forgiving yourself. You know, we when we play concerts, things are always going to go wrong if we're not a machine on stage. And I think it's in the embracing of that going wrong and the relaxing within that. I mean, obviously you're not choosing to go wrong and you have a certain regret when things don't go the way you want them, but a letting go. And I think that letting go is a real key to mental health in this crazy life of traveling around playing concerts.
So I'm going to continue just sort of reading back quotes to you from the book, because I think this is a really interesting way of hearing how you think and sort of how you approach going up your art and your performances and just the way you sort of think about things too. There's a reflection in the book called Could God Exist? And in it, you write, one of the reasons atheism falls short for me is in its lack of someone or something to thank for those moments of ecstasy that we experience in life, those gifts that have no human source. And I'm wondering if maybe you could identify some of those moments that you have in mind and some of those gifts.
Well, they can be very small things, can't they? They can be just, you know, it's raining today for the first time in a few weeks. And I stepped out this morning and the air had this incredible freshness about it. Now, I'm actually feeling grateful for it now more than I was at the time, because at the time I wanted to get over to my studio and get working, and I wasn't thinking about those blessings around. But I think it can be small things, just like one lungful of damp, fresh air that's just so wonderful. Yeah, we can just say, well, that's very nice. But I think there is a sort of sense in which we want to pour out ourselves. We have this instinct to be selfish because that's how we exist. We want to preserve our existence. We don't want someone to run us over when we're crossing the street. But I think also we want to give of ourselves. We want to pour out ourselves for others. And I think that's related to this sense of gratitude and this sense of realizing those blessings. And I think all of us have had that experience of a moment, maybe not very characteristic of generosity, and how wonderful that feels. Not the sense that we give ourselves a pat on the back and say, you know, how good I am, but just that sense of releasing some energy from ourselves to someone else and seeing that that's exactly what they needed at that time. I don't think there's any better feeling than that, really. And I think a lot of people have been sensing that, haven't they, during this lockdown, you know, that telephone call to someone who lives alone, you know, the sense of absolute joy that they're so happy you phoned. And I think that's something I think of what I was meaning in that book. How do we, if we have no one in a sense to thank, where does that go? And of course, it does go to other people, but I think we'd run out of resources very quickly if we were just relying on our own batteries to charge the whole city. You know, we're part of a bigger picture in that sense of power.
There's a section in your book where you cite the apocryphal quote from St. Augustine, who says, "He who sings prays twice," which is something I think a lot of us who were raised going to Mass heard from elders and other people kind of encouraging us to join in. But you use it to underscore the idea that music adds a dimension to the communicative power of words. But then you add, conversely, I do think someone who can sing passionately of belief in the Holy Ghost in a Mass setting while being utterly convinced that all religion is ghosts and nonsense. So can you explain a little bit more what you mean by this?
Yeah, I just think, I mean, right back to childhood, I remember loving, I grew up in initially an Anglican Episcopal background and then more evangelical. And I remember singing hymns when I was a child and actually not realizing a word that they meant. I mean, the actual words, some of them were quite complex because they were Victorian hymns or earlier with language that seemed a little bit outdated. You know, when I was 8 and 9, I didn't really think about what those words meant. But somehow I still sang them with all my lungs and they still meant something to me. They still actually, well, I can't say they were a prayer, but they were this outpouring that, you know, is this ecstatic thing that I think all of us have within. And I think a lot of us have that feeling. We can sing sometimes in a foreign language if we're singing in a choir and not really understand the words we're singing, but we know what's behind them somehow. We don't actually have to sing each individual one. It's interesting, actually, Dominic, that you mentioned this, because a conductor friend of mine asked me to write some notes for a recording he's making of The Dream of Gerontius, the Elgar Oratorio. And he's not a believer. He was brought up a Catholic. He's now an agnostic. But he said, why is it that this music still makes me cry, even though no longer do I really believe in the words by Cardinal Newman? And they're very, very specifically Catholic. They're littered with Mary, pray for me, and holy saints and angels and the souls of purgatory. I mean, it's very, very incense-laden in that sense. And he doesn't accept any of it now. But he wants to know, and he wanted me to write something about why he still has immense respect for the belief behind the creative process that led to that work. So I am exploring some of those thoughts at the moment. And I suppose I'm a bit of a universalist, really, in that sense. I do think that our feeblest efforts, it's not just that they're rewarded by God, but that we've already been chosen before. We've set, you know, that we've passed the exam before we sit down at the desk to write the answer to the questions. To me, I do, and I think I'm not alone in more recent theological thought about this. You know, the idea that I can't believe that everyone won't be saved. And I've written about this actually in my novel, which is quite a disturbing book about a priest with a sex addiction. But this is his diary. And he writes in the chapters when he's trying to overcome his doubts about this, that all people will be saved. And in the same way that hell, I sort of put hell being an impossibility besides it being an impossibility for Abraham actually to kill Isaac. I don't think God wanted to see Abraham's reaction. And, you know, when Abraham didn't want to do this, that was exactly what God wanted to see. He wanted to see an independent person saying, no, God, you've got this wrong. You can't mean me to kill my son. And God said, no, you're right. I didn't mean you to kill your son at all. And that was just the reaction. I think we have to go to God and say, you can't mean this hell business. It's ridiculous. It's awful. It's the worst thing ever conceived in the human mind. And God said, yeah, that's right. That's what I wanted you to say. So that's a little vignette from the novel's called The Final Retreat. And that was something that I covered there. But I think in the same way that someone singing is praying, they may not realize it, but they are. And I think if organized religion, if Catholicism has anything to do, it's to lead someone to realize that what they've been doing all along might have a name to it.
So this kind of makes me want to ask about another essay in your book, and it's one of the longer ones, and I think it's a significant one, and I'm specifically recommending it to our listeners. It's entitled, Is He Musical? This is one of the longer reflections in your book, as I said, and I'm wondering first if you could tell us what the title refers to, and then I'll ask you to take up an idea that you present in this passage. We are subject to natural law as part of creation, but we're also able to contemplate it and relish it. It is the great epiphany of reality, what is actually there, not what we would like to be there or what our forebears have told us is there. When the world in which we live tells us a different story from what we were taught, we eventually have to break free.
Right. Well, the title, this is something that was a common way, I think, around the Victorian time of asking, is someone homosexual, is someone gay? Is he musical? So it's what, you know, it's one of those things you don't even want to mention the word, but this was a way around it. Is he musical? So that was the, of course, that's my life, music. So I thought it was a neat way of introducing this chapter. When you grow up, I mean, I realized that looking back now that I was gay from the age of about 5, I had very strong affective feelings for other men, other boys, rather, of my own age, at a time long before I knew what anything was. And as I grew older, I started to recognize those feelings for what they were. And then eventually I was able to put a name to them. And they're exactly the same feelings that just developed as I developed over those years. Now, in my evangelical background, of course, I also was told that this was sinful. It's a slightly different take, I suppose, from the Catholic one, because in the evangelical understanding, you are saved and nothing can take that away. You can't, you know, no sin can take away that salvation. So it wasn't a matter of going to confession, but I certainly spent many time on my knees at night, you know, with the Psalms, reading and trying to feel repentant and trying to suppress these feelings. And eventually, one of the things that was so wonderful to me when I became a Catholic was, and I wanted to become a priest, was, my goodness, these are people who never have to answer that question again. Why aren't you married? Why haven't you got a girlfriend? Because I'm a priest. I can't. And it was such, I thought, what a release that would be to have that as my excuse when my mother would say, you know, have you got a girlfriend yet? Or what about, you know, Joanne, isn't she pretty? And all of that. I could just sweep it aside and wouldn't have to answer that. And I know, because I've spoken to them, but I also suspect with many, many more, that some people did enter the priesthood with that as one of the reasons. You come from a large family, big Irish, big Italian, big Polish family, you know, 10 kids, 12 kids, everyone's getting married, you have same-sex attraction. How do you tell anybody that? Well, of course you can't, because you risk being thrown out of the house and never spoken to again by those whom you love the most, your family. So those are some things that are explored in that chapter, and indeed also in the novel. But yeah, I think in the end, it was reading Love and Responsibility of Pope John Paul II, Saint John Paul II, and realizing what a wonderful vision he has of the goodness of the flesh, you know, and of sexual attraction and appetite and relationships. And that this is something absolutely embedded in the world that God created and wanted us to live in. And so it's a very small step from there to, well, if this is, let's leave human beings aside for a minute, but if this is in the animal kingdom, if this is something which is in penguins and which is in monkeys and which is in other parts of life, and of course also in human life, Catholicism tells me that the creation is something good. So what? Did God make a mistake? Is this just something that we've messed up? And even if it isn't the ideal, there are many things that are not the ideal. God makes or allows people to be made with one hand or with no hands or with no legs. Or, I mean, these are not ideal situations. And I'm not actually comparing homosexuality with that, but I think you can come at this from many different angles and from many different levels of acceptance and understanding. But it seems to me that this natural world that we're told to reverence and to love, God saw it and it was very good. You know, that's repeated 6 times in the first book of the Bible, and it was very good, and it was very good. It's a mantra of blessing. And if we find that homosexuality is also in creation, or as Hopkins puts it, the dappled things, you know, the fact that things are not always just simple black and white, that they're multicolored, and then perhaps there's a way for that to be also something that God thought was very good, because God made that.
I want to go back to the new book and talk about some of the, you have a number of shorter pieces in the book that touch on hospice care, dignity and end-of-life issues and the confronting of death. Death, which as you write, God allows. He could stop it. Yet as every second strikes, lungs cease to breathe, hearts cease to beat. And I'm wondering if you find yourself considering these things more in a different way now than maybe you once did. Has your thinking and writing on these notions perhaps prepared you for the moment that we live in now and the challenges of living in a time of pandemic?
Yes, it's difficult, isn't it? I do think there's a strange contradiction at the heart of a lot of pro-life thinking. And I'm not actually, let's leave aside the abortion issue, which I do also talk about in the book. It was a challenge, that chapter, actually, when I wrote a blog from someone who said to me, you never say what you think about these. You're always trying to have the middle ground, which is true, because I do think that we begin by meeting on the middle ground before we go to any specifics. So I wrote that article on abortion with a way to try and bring both sides together. It seems an impossible task, but I set myself an impossible task. But at the other end of the spectrum, I do think it's strange, you know, if we really believe that God is waiting for us, the other side of death, that our whole existence has its fulfillment at that moment, that everything we've been living for, that's the great chord at the end of our life, that's the beginning of our real meaning as human beings. I do think it's strange that people are so worried about stopping people dying in those last months, you know, of doing everything they possibly can with artificial means and feeding tubes and people who are suffering terribly and in these situations of absolute hopelessness and families being torn apart with distress. And I don't know. I mean, I'm not advocating euthanasia, but I do think that I can't quite imagine God being so worried about it as we are if we believe in eternal life. I don't quite see that. And I think that's something that perhaps in the present time, and I think it's something that, you know, those with no faith should be clinging on to every second. Those with faith, well, if I live another month, well, that could be good, but let me leave that to God. You know, my body's packing up. Well, maybe it's time to go. Is that such a problem if I believe that I'm going into a blissful eternity? And I think sometimes people with very good pro-life credentials don't seem to me to live to follow that argument through. You know, why would we be pro-life? We're pro-life because we believe that life is eternal. And so, yeah, well, you know, maybe it's okay. And actually, even when the medical profession, of course, I'm not talking about, I mean, this can descend to the most grotesque level. And we've seen in the 20th century, particularly, that this taken to levels of absolutely of abomination. But on the other hand, doctors do make mistakes, and it is terrible in a way. But again, if that mistake leads someone into the arms of God, yes, we need to protect life at every level, but maybe it's not the absolute disaster that we think it is. And sometimes we have to let go.
Stephen Huff's latest book is Rough Ideas, Reflections on Music and More, published by FSG here in the United States. Stephen, I really want to thank you for your time today.
My pleasure, Dominic. It's been lovely chatting. Thank you.
The Commonweal Podcast is produced by assistant editor Griffin Olenek and the Commonweal staff in partnership with Sandberg Media. Wally Boudway composed the music, and David Dalt did the editing. For the Commonweal Podcast, this is Dominic Preziosi.